You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 83 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Attention Between East and West. 11 lectures, actually 10 lectures, translated by B.A. Rowley. This is Lecture 2, entitled Anthroposophy and Psychology, given in Vienna on June 2, 1922. When the riddles of existence concern the human soul, they become not only great problems in life, but life itself. They become the happiness or sorrow of human existence, and not a passing happiness or sorrow only, but one we must carry for a time through life, so that by this experience of happiness or sorrow, we become fit or unfit for life. Now, the human being's attitude to his own soul is such that the most important questions about it and about its spiritual essence do not arise from any actual doubts he has regarding the spiritual element within him. It is precisely because he is certain of his spiritual substance, and because he cannot help seeing in it his human dignity and his true significance as a human being, that the question of the fate of his soul becomes for him a tremendous riddle. To deny the mind in the human being himself does not, of course, occur to even the most rigid materialist. He acknowledges the mind as such, regarding it as a result of physical material processes. Yet if anyone who, with no such theory, but simply from the deepest needs of his soul, seeks to know the fate of this soul of his, he will find himself confronted by a plethora of phenomena and experiences, which must become riddles to him, precisely because he is fully conscious of the soul's spiritual life, and must accordingly ask, is this spiritual life a passing breath, rising from physical existence and returning with it once more into the generality of natural phenomena? Or is it connected with the spiritual world, within which it has eternal significance? Of the many experiences in the realm of the soul which present the riddles of the soul to our spiritual eye, EYE, I will select only two. There are, it may be objected, very few people for whom such experiences are so pressing as to become conscious, let alone theoretical, questions of the soul. But that is not the point. The point is that these experiences take hold of the subconscious or unconscious, establish themselves there, and flow up into consciousness only as a general soul mood, which can be positive or negative, either making us courageous and energetic in life, or making us dejected, so that we cannot properly come to grips with life. As I have said, I want to pick out only two of these experiences. The first appears before the soul's eye, EYE, every evening when we fall asleep, when what flows and weaves up and down during the day then sinks down into the unconscious, as if extinguished. Now when he looks at this experience, or as is most often the case, when the unconscious awareness of it affects his soul, the human being is overcome by a sense of the powerlessness of his soul life in face of the outside world. And precisely because the human being sees in this life his most valuable and dignified quality, and cannot deny that he is in the true sense of the word a spiritual being, he is assailed from within by this sensation of powerlessness, and has to ponder the question, does the general process of nature overpower soul experiences when one passes through the gate of death, just as it always does at the onset of sleep? The first experience, if I may so put it, is a sense of the powerlessness of the life of the soul. The second experience is in a way the direct opposite of the first. We perceive it distinctly or indistinctly, consciously or unconsciously, when on waking, perhaps after passing through a fantastically chaotic dream world not attuned to reality, our spirit descends into our bodily existence. At such times we feel how this soul-spiritual element takes hold of our senses, how we have permeated our soul experience through the interplay between the outside world and our senses, which are, of course, of a physical and physiological nature. We feel how the spiritual element descends further into our bodily nature. We take hold of our organs of will with it and become alert and self-possessed, able to make use of our body, our organism. On reflection, however, we cannot help realizing. Anatomy and physiology make a valiant attempt to penetrate and analyze the bodily functions from without. Yet, looking from within, we ourselves, by means of ordinary consciousness, do not know anything about the interrelationship between our spiritual element and our bodily functions. A glance at the simplest bodily function controlled by the will, the lifting of an arm or movement of a hand, tells us, first, there exists in us the inner picture or thought of this arm lifting or hand movement. How this inner picture of thought flows down into our organism, however, how it takes hold of our muscles, and how, finally, there comes about what again we know only through observation. What actually goes on inside remains hidden from ordinary consciousness. So too, in that wonderful mechanism that physics and physiology show us, the human eye, EYE, or some other sense organ, there remains hidden the spiritual element that takes hold of this wonderful mechanism. We are thus faced with problems both by the powerlessness of our soul life and by the darkness into which we feel our spirit descending when it flows down into our own body. We are forced to conclude, most people certainly don't do so consciously, but it affects them as the mood of their soul. This spiritual element, in its relationship with the organism, is unknown to us precisely when it is creative. It is unknown to us at the very moment in physical life when it manifests its outgoing function. What every naive individual thus experiences extends in a different form to psychology itself. It would need a great many words to explain scientifically how these enigmas creep into the subject, but we can put it rather superficially, perhaps, as follows. On the one hand, psychology looks at the soul and asks, what is the relation between this and the physical, the external, corporeal aspect? In looking at the physical, on the other hand, and at what physical science has to say about it, and in this respect psychology has a long history, some people believe that we must regard the soul as the actually effective cause of the physical. Others believe that we must regard the body as the element that actually has the power, and the soul only as a kind of effect of the body. The unsatisfactory nature of both views has been perceived by recent psychologists. They have therefore set up the curious theory of psychophysical parallelism, according to which one cannot say that the body affects the soul or the soul the body, but only corporeal processes are parallel to mental ones, and mental processes to bodily ones. One can only say what mental processes accompany the corporeal, or what corporeal ones the mental. Psychology itself, moreover, is conscious of this powerlessness of the mind. If we attempt to examine the mind, even as it presents itself to the psychologist with ordinary consciousness, we find that it has something passive about it, so that we cannot see how it can penetrate dynamically the life of the body. Anyone who looks at the soul qualities of thinking and feeling, willing is impenetrable. So for psychology, much the same is true of willing as of thinking and feeling. Anyone who looks at thinking and feeling with the tools of psychology finds them powerless and cannot find anything that would really be capable of effectively taking hold of the physical. It is then that the psychologist experiences his sense of the powerlessness of soul life in the eyes of ordinary consciousness. The most varied attempts have certainly been made to overcome this feeling. But the disputes of philosophers and the changing philosophies that have succeeded one another provide the impartial observer of the human being with factual evidence, showing how impossible it is for ordinary consciousness to approach this soul experience. For everywhere there arises a sense of the powerlessness of that soul element which is perceived by ordinary consciousness. With regard to this particular point, a series of works have appeared here in Vienna, which represent milestones in the development of philosophy. Although I cannot associate myself in any way with their content, I believe that from the standpoint of ordinary consciousness, these books are extraordinarily significant. They include Richard Wahle's title Das Ganze der Philosophie und ihrer Ende, The Whole of Philosophy and Its End, which is designed to show that ordinary consciousness is incapable of reaching any significant conclusion about the life of the soul, and that what philosophical investigation is here attempting ought to be handed over to theology, physiology, aesthetics, and social science. And Richard Wahle went on to work out these ideas still more clearly in his title Über den Mechanismus des geistigen Lebens, On the Mechanism of Spiritual Life. We may say, here for once ordinary consciousness is revealed as basically incapable of saying anything about the problems of soul life, the I, capital, the soul unity, everything that earlier psychology brought to light. All these collapse before the self-criticism exercised by ordinary consciousness. In recent years, however, psychology has understandably and indeed of necessity not attempted to deal directly with the soul, in face of which, as we have seen, ordinary consciousness is powerless, but has sought to discover something about what are usually called mental phenomena indirectly, via the physical phenomena that spring from them. In this way, experimental psychology has come into being. This is a necessary product of our present attitude toward life and our methods of research. And anyone taking the philosophical standpoint that I do will never for one moment deny that experimental psychology is completely justified, though he may not perhaps agree entirely with this or that detail of its methods and results. It is here that the other riddle of the soul comes in. However much we learn about what can be experienced by the human body in experimental psychology, the fact remains. Everything that appears to be discovered in this way about purely psychological functions is, strictly speaking, only indirect knowledge acquired via the body. It all belongs to a sphere which at death is given over to the general process of nature, so that through it can be learned nothing about the soul, whose fate in the world is of such paramount concern to man. Thus we may say, for psychology also the great riddle of the soul reappears. This point, too, has been made by a modern psychologist who for many years lived and worked here in Vienna, and who will never be forgotten by those who sat at his feet here, as I did. In the first volume of his unfinished work on psychology, he asks, what can any psychology ever achieve, whether experimentally or non-experimentally? I might add, by establishing how concepts combine and separate, how attention operates, how memory develops in life, etc. If, precisely because of the scientific character of this psychology, with its emulation of natural science, we must renounce all claim to understand the fate of the human soul once the body crumbles into its elements. This was said not by some eccentric or other, but by that rigorous thinker Franz Brentano, who made psychology his central concern in life, and who sought to apply to his work the strict method of modern science. Yet he it was who presented the riddle of the soul to his contemporaries in the way I have just outlined, as something scientifically unavoidable. From all this, the impartial observer today must draw a conclusion, It is that in the study of man, scientific methods will take us only to the point they have now reached, but that we cannot deal with the soul by means of ordinary consciousness, entirely adequate as this is for science and for ordinary life. And so, since for scientific reasons, this fact must be apparent to the impartial observer today, I speak to you from the standpoint of a worldview that concludes it is impossible, with the soul powers that manifest themselves to ordinary consciousness and operate in ordinary life and ordinary science, to investigate the life of the soul. There must be developed other powers, which to ordinary consciousness are more or less sleeping, or, let us say, latent in the soul. To adopt the right attitude to such a conception of life, we need something which, if I may say so, is found only rarely in people today. I would call it intellectual modesty. There must come a moment in life when we say to ourselves, "When I was a little child, I developed a soul life that was so dim and dreamy that it has been forgotten like a dream. Only gradually did there arise from this dreamlike soul life of the child something that enables me to orient myself in life, to bring my thoughts, my impulses, and my decisions into step with the world, and to become a capable being. Out of the vague and undifferentiated nature of the child's soul life, interwoven with the body, has emerged that experience which derives from our inherited qualities, as they develop with the growth of the body, and which derives also from our customary education. Anyone looking back with intellectual modesty on his development during life on earth will not be above saying to himself at a certain point, "Why shouldn't this continue? The soul powers which are the most important to me today and by which I orient myself in life and become a capable being were dormant during my existence as a child. Why shouldn't there be dormant in my soul other powers that I can develop from it?" We cannot help reaching this conclusion, which springs from intellectual modesty. I call it intellectual modesty, because people are inclined to say, "The form of consciousness I have attained as an adult is that of a normal person. Any impulse in the life of the soul to be different from this so-called normal consciousness is eccentric, or hallucinatory, or visionary, or something similar." The philosophical standpoint from which I speak definitely starts from a healthy soul and attempts on this basis to develop powers dormant in the soul, cognitive powers, which then become clairvoyant powers in the sense in which I spoke yesterday of exact clairvoyance. What the soul has to undertake, I indicated yesterday. I mention my book's title, Knowledge of the Higher Worlds and Its Attainment, title, An Outline of Occult Science, title, Riddles of the Soul, and so on. There you will find details of those exercises which, starting from a healthy soul life, lead upward to the development of the soul, which thus, in fact, attains a kind of spiritual vision with which it can see into a spiritual world, just as with the ordinary sense organs it can perceive the physical sensory world. In each of these books there is a first part, which is accepted as something that can be definitely useful to man, even by many opponents of the worldview I am advocating. It shows that by certain exercises of an intellectual, emotional, and moral kind, the human being can produce in himself a state of soul and body that can be regarded as entirely healthy. They also enable him to be on his inner guard against anything which, deriving from an unhealthy life of the soul, leads to mediumism, hallucinations, and visions. For everything brought about in this way is unacceptable to a true psychology. Visions arise not from the sphere of the soul, but because diseased structures exist in the organism. The same is true of mediumism. None of these have anything to do with sound psychology and sound soul development. And indeed, from the point of view of this sound psychology, all must be condemned. Opponents today, however, find fantastic and harmful the exercises which follow these preparatory ones, and which are designed to draw from the soul those powers of thinking, feeling, and willing, which, once they are trained, introduce the human being into a spiritual world in such a way that he learns to orient himself in it and can enter it at will. I have already suggested how, as modern people, we manage, by certain thought exercises, to remove thinking from its ordinary state of passive surrender to the phenomena of the outside world, and to what appear inwardly as memories, but are also connected with the outside world. We transcend this kind of thinking by carrying out exercises in meditation seriously, patiently, and energetically, and by repeating them over and over again. Depending on predisposition, it may take one person years, another not so long. But each can note, as he arrives at the crucial point, how his thinking, from what I have previously called dead and abstract thinking, becomes inwardly living thinking in tune with the rhythm of the world. A balanced view of the world and of life thus strives not to conjure up visions or hallucinations from the soul, but to experience the life of thoughts and concepts with an intensity that we otherwise experience only through the outer senses. You need only take the vitality of our experience of the colors we perceive through the eye, Y-E, and the sounds we hear through the ear, and compare it with the pallor of our experience of thought in ordinary consciousness. By energizing our thought life in the way I suggested yesterday, we can gradually give the mere life of thought the same intensive quality as the life of the senses. Man today seeking to know the spiritual does not, therefore, if he is a reasonable being, seek hallucinations and visions. He strives quite calmly to achieve the ideal of the life of the senses with its intensity and plasticity in his life of thought. And if you devote yourselves as students of the Spirit to meditations such as I have described, you need not be in any way dependent on the unconscious or subconscious. You can refer to the exercises. They are all directed at what I am trying to describe, and you will find that everything that is carried out by way of exercises in the life of the soul is done as consciously, as reasonably, as precisely, we may say, as are operations in mathematics or geometry. Therefore, we can say that we are concerned here not with the old nebulous clairvoyance, but with a clairvoyance brought about by fully conscious and balanced experiences and exercises of the soul. The clear-headedness at each step is such that we can compare what a person experiences and makes of himself here with what we otherwise experience in the case of a geometrical problem. If not, the exercises have no value. A conceptual life of this kind is energized, is independent of breathing, is set free of the body, is a spiritual function only. And in it, as we know by direct perception, thinking is carried out not by the body, but in the purely spiritual sphere. Only when modern man attains this kind of conceptual life does he feel his thinking in contrast to abstract thinking as something vital and not as something dead. Our sensation when we experience the transition from ordinary abstract thinking to living thinking is exactly as if we found a dead organism suddenly come to life. And although this living thinking is a spiritual process, it is not so linear, not so superficial as ordinary abstract thinking. It is inwardly full and vivid, and this vividness is what counts. Now, a very great deal depends on our carrying over the balanced attitude required during the actual exercise to the moment when this vitalized thinking, this malleable thinking, appears in us. If at this moment we surrender ourselves to the images we have struggled to achieve, believing them to be realities of a spiritual kind, then we are not spiritual researchers, but simply fantasizers. This is something we must certainly not become, for it could not provide us with a firmly grounded modern worldview. Only when we say to ourselves, we have arrived at one content of spiritual life, but it is an image content that merely tells us something about powers that operate within us, about what we ourselves can do through our own human nature. Only when we really say to ourselves, this imaginative knowledge, as I usually call it, cannot give us any information about any kind of outside world, not even about what we are in the outside world. Only when we perceive ourselves in this image-making, in this image-weaving, when we know ourselves as a power living within it, only then do we have the right attitude toward this experience. Only then do we feel ourselves within ourself, feel ourselves as soul spiritual beings outside the body, and yet feel ourselves only in ourself, with an inner image character of our being. Only by having the courage to continue the exercises to the next stage do we attain true spiritual perception. This next stage not only involves developing the capacity to focus our consciousness upon certain concepts that are readily comprehended, in the way we comprehend geometrical concepts, which contain no unconscious element, so as to increase our strength of soul, it must also and more particularly involve being able calmly and at will to banish these concepts from our consciousness. This is, in some circumstances, a difficult task. In ordinary life, forgetting is not particularly difficult, as we know all too well. But when one has just struggled without driving oneself to auto-suggestion, which cannot occur if one is clear-headed, to focus one's consciousness upon certain concepts, then unusual strength is required to banish them from consciousness again. However, one must develop this greater strength gradually. And just as at first we concentrated all our attention and inner strength of soul so that we might dwell upon such a concept in a state of meditation, so now we must dispel these concepts and all other concepts calmly and voluntarily from consciousness. And there must be able to enter from our will what one might call, in quotes, empty consciousness. What empty consciousness, if only for a few moments, implies can be judged by reflecting on what happens to ordinary consciousness when it has to forego sense impressions, has to forego inner pictures born of memory. When, for some reason or other, one is deprived of external impressions and even memories, one falls asleep. That is, consciousness is depressed and dimmed. The opposite of this must happen. Completely lucid, conscious wakefulness, despite the fact that everything has been removed from consciousness through inner will. If we thus first strengthen the soul, and then empty it, while keeping it conscious, there will appear before it, as color before the eye and sounds before the ear, a spiritual environment. We can look into the spiritual world, and so we may say, to the spiritual investigation here intended, it is perfectly understandable that ordinary consciousness cannot reach the spirit and the soul, and indeed that it turns out, as Richard Wahle found, for instance, that ordinary consciousness ought not to speak of an I, capital, at all. For in this sphere, ordinary experience can only indicate and label with words a dark element which is immersed in and contrasted with the clear light, and which will not emerge until we have developed powers that are usually lacking. It is a sober recognition of the limits of ordinary consciousness, bound as it is to the body, that impels us to develop in ourselves those powers that alone are capable of really discovering the soul and the spirit. There is another point to consider, however, if you seek to arrive by this path at a sound and not a pathological psychology. Taking the mediumistic, visionary, and hallucinatory as pathological, the fact is that anyone who falls into this kind of pathological soul activity is entirely absorbed into it. For the duration of his sickness of soul, at least, he becomes one with this activity. Quite the reverse is true with regard to the exercises I have been proposing here. Anyone who explores the soul with their aid does, it is true, leave behind his physical body with its capacity for ordinary thinking and ordinary orientation in life. He steps out of this body and learns to see imaginatively, free of body. He develops a thinking that beholds. Yet not for a moment is he completely subsumed in this higher human being, if I may so call it without arrogance. He always remains capable of regaining his body and acting just as calmly as before. There always stands beside this more highly developed human being that ordinary human being with his healthy common sense, who is a sober critic of everything to which, in his vision, this higher being attains. By developing pictorial living thinking and then creating an empty consciousness, we reach a view of our own soul nature, one that embraces in a single image all we have encountered in this life since we entered it. Our past life does not stand before the soul, as is usual for memory, with isolated reminiscences emerging, independently or after some exertion. Instead, all at once, our life is surveyed like a mighty tableau, not in space, but in time. All at once, with a single glance of the soul, we survey our life. But we see it as it informs our growth and the energies of our physical body. We see ourselves as we have been here on this earth, as thinking, feeling, willing beings. But in such a way that thinking, feeling, and willing now densify, and at the same time organize themselves within the human being. We can see into our spiritual life in its direct connection with the physical. We cease trying to establish by philosophical speculation how the soul affects the body. In seeing the soul, we also see how, at every moment, our physical life on earth has been informed by what the tableau shows us. This will be described more fully in the next few days. The next step must now be to remove from our consciousness the energized inner pictures, Kraftvorstellungen, that we have introduced into ourselves, and thereby to strengthen them more and more. We strengthen them by continually repeating the exercises, just as we strengthen our muscles by repeated exercise. And by continuing with these energized inner pictures, we also manage to eliminate from our consciousness the entire newly achieved tableau of the life of the soul from birth to the present. This requires more effort than the simple elimination of images, but one does eventually achieve it. We succeed in removing from consciousness what in our earthly existence we call our inner life, so that now our consciousness is empty, not only of current impressions, but also of all that we experience within ourselves as if in a second, finer body, which yet works into our growth and our memory, a finer human being, an etheric human being, as it were, a now for the first time supersensible human being. And when we do so, our consciousness, which though fully awake, is now empty, and yet has attained a greater inner power, will be able to see further in the spiritual world. It will now be able to look at the nature of its own soul before this descended from spiritual worlds to an earthly existence. Now, what we call the eternity of the human soul is taken out of the sphere of mere philosophical speculation and actually beheld. We learn to look at the purely soul-spiritual being that we were in a spiritual world before we descended to clothe ourselves through conception, fetal life, and birth in a physical earthly body. Although attained by as exact a method as our mathematical concepts, this may seem fantastic to many people today. Still more paradoxical may appear what remains to be said not only about the soul, when it still had a spiritual existence, but also about the concrete nature of this experience. These things can only be suggested in this lecture. More will be said in subsequent lectures. The suggestions can perhaps be explained in the following terms. Let us first ask ourselves, what do we actually see when in ordinary life, as beings who recognize, understand, and perceive, we enter into a relationship with our natural environment? We actually see only the external world. This is clear from what I mentioned at the beginning of today's lecture. We actually see only the outside world, the cosmos. What takes place within us, we see too, but only by making it into something external through physiology and anatomy. Imposing as these sciences may be, we see what is within only by first externalizing it, and then investigating it exactly as we are accustomed to do with external processes. Yet it remains dark down there in the region into which we descend, where we feel our spiritual element flowing into our body. In the last analysis, we see in ordinary life only what is outside ourselves. Through direct observation, we cannot look into the human being and see how the spiritual informs the bodily organs. Anyone, however, who can examine life impartially from the spiritual viewpoint I have established, will conclude, noble and great is external appearance, and the laws we discover in the external world of the stars and of the sun, which sends us light and warmth. Noble and great is our experience when we either simply look and are complete human beings in this looking, or when we investigate scientifically the laws by which the sun sends us light and warmth and conjures forth the green of plants. Noble and great is all of this. But if we could look into the structure of the human heart, its inner law would be even nobler and greater than what we perceive outside. Man can sense this with his ordinary consciousness, but the science that rests on exact clairvoyance can raise it to a result of real research. It can say, far-reaching appear to us the changes in the atmosphere, and there exists an ideal of science which here too will discover greater and more potent laws. But greater still is what is present and goes on in the structure and functions of the human lung. It is not a question of size. Man is a microcosm in face of the macrocosm. But as Schiller said, quote, "But, friends, the sublime dwells not in space," close quote. He means the highest form of the sublime. This highest form can be experienced only in the human organism itself. Between birth and death, the human being does not investigate it with his ordinary consciousness. Exactly the opposite is true, however, of our existence before we unite with the body, our spiritual existence in a spiritual environment. In this life on earth, the inner world is dark, and the outer world of the cosmos is bright and full of sound. In the purely spiritual life, before our earthly embodiment, the outer cosmic world is dark, and our world is then the inner world of man. We see this inner world, and truly, it seems to us no smaller and no less majestic than does the cosmos when we see it with our physical eyes during our earthly existence. As if it were our, quote, outer world, close quote, we come to understand the law of our spiritual inner world, and we prepare ourselves in the spiritual realm for dealing later with our bodily functions, with what we are between birth and death. For what we are between birth and death extends before us like a world, before we descend into this physical existence on earth. This is not speculation. It is direct perception, arising from exact clairvoyance. It is something which, starting from this exact clairvoyance, leads us some way into the connection between the eternal element in man and life on earth, that eternal element which remains hidden from us between birth and death, and of which we see the first glimmers when we are able to perceive it in the still unembodied state. And with this, we explore a part of human eternity itself. We don't even have a word in our modern languages for this part of human eternity. We rightly speak of immortality, but we ought also to speak of, in quotes, unbornness. For this now confronts us as direct knowledge. This is one aspect of exact clairvoyance, one aspect of human eternity, of the great riddle of the human soul, and thus of the foremost problem of psychology in general. The other aspect arises from those other exercises, which I, yesterday, termed exercises of the will, through which we so take in hand our will that we learn to make use of it independently of the body. I explained that these exercises induce us to overcome pain and suffering within the soul, in order to make it into a, in quotes, sense organ, to speak loosely, into a spiritual organ of vision, to speak exactly, so that we not only see the spiritual, but see it in its authentic form. And when we learn to have experiences in this way, outside our body, not only with our thoughts, but with our will itself, that is, with our entire being, there appears before the soul the image of death in such a way that we now know the nature of experience without the body. In thinking and in willing and in what lies between, feeling. In an imaginally creative way, we learn to live without the body. And in doing so, we gain an image of our passage through the gate of death. We learn how, in reality, too, we can do without the body, and how, passing through the gate of death, we enter once more that spiritual sphere from which we descended into this bodily existence. What is eternal and immortal in us becomes not only philosophical certainty, but direct perception. By training the will, we reveal for the soul's contemplation the other side of eternity, immortality, just as unbornness is revealed through the training of thought. When the soul becomes a spiritual organ in this way, however, it is as if, at a lower level, a person born blind had been operated on. What, for those endowed with sight, is a world of colors, the blind person has hitherto been accustomed to perceive by touch alone. Now, after the operation, he sees something quite new. The world in which he previously lived has changed. So, too, anyone whose soul eye, EYE, is opened in the way I have described, finds that his environment is changed. How far it is changed, I wish to bring out today in only one respect. Even with our unopened soul eye, we can see in life how, for example, a person takes his first steps in childhood, then grows up and reaches a fateful moment in his life. He meets someone and their souls unite so that the two people combine their fates and move on through life together. As I said before, I want to single out just one event. In ordinary consciousness, we are drawn to regard what happens in life as a sum of chance occurrences, to regard it also as more or less happenstance, that we are brought at last to this fateful meeting with the other person. Only a few individuals, like Goethe's friend Knebel, gain an inner wisdom of experience simply in growing older. He once put this to Goethe in the following words: "If at an advanced age one looks back on the course of one's steps in life, one finds that these steps seem to reveal a systematic arrangement, so that everything appears to have been present in embryo, and to have developed in such a way that one was led by a kind of inner necessity to what we now see to have been a fateful event." The human life seen with an opened soul eye is to the life seen with an unopened soul eye what the world of colors is to the merely tactile world of the blind person. Looking at the child's soul life and the interplay of sympathy and antipathy, we see how it develops from these first steps, how then, welling up out of his innermost being, the human being himself, out of his innermost longings, directs his steps and brings himself to the fateful moment. This is sober observation of life. When we look at life in this way, however, we see it rather as we see the life of an old man. We should not say that an old man's life simply exists, quote, in its own right, close quote. By logical processes, we know how to refer it to its infant beginnings. Its first idiosyncrasies make us so refer it. What simple logic does for the old man's life is done for human life in general by exact clairvoyance, by true vision. If we are really to look at life as it develops from the innermost longings of the soul, we must follow it back. And when we do so, we come to earlier lives on earth, in which were prepared the longings that appear in the present and lead to our activities. I have not been able to do more today than suggest that what leads to this comprehensive contemplation of life is no mere fantasy, but an exact method. It is a contemplation which, by means of an advanced psychology, penetrates to the eternal in human nature. And on this foundation there now arises something that is a certainty, something that wells up out of the knowledge appropriate to us as modern human beings today, and forms a basis for true inner piety and true inner religious life. Anyone with an insight, and I may say that I am using the word insight in its literal sense, into the way the individual soul struggles free of the body in order to enter a spiritual realm, we'll have a different way of looking at our social life, too. Armed with this new attitude, he can see how friendships, relationships of love, and other associations are formed, how soul finds its way to soul, moving outside the family and other social groups, how physical proximity may be a means to the community of souls, the sympathy and togetherness of souls. He now knows that just as the body falls away from the individual soul, so the physical element and all earthly events fall away from the friendships and from the relationships of love. And he sees how the soul relationship that has come into being between people continues into a spiritual world, where it can also be spiritually experienced. On a foundation of knowledge, not of faith, we can now say, as they stride through the gate of death, human beings find themselves once more together. And just as the body which impedes our sight of the spirit disappears in the spiritual world, so too, in that world, every impediment to friendship and love now disappears. Human beings are closer together there than in the flesh. A mode of knowledge that may still appear abstract in relation to true psychology, culminates in this religious feeling and vision. Yet the worldview I am here presenting does not seek to infringe on religious faith. This worldview can be tolerant. It can recognize fully the value of every individual religious faith, and even exercise it in practice. But at the same time, as a nurse to this religious life, it provides an epistemological basis for this religious life as well. I have sought today to say something fundamental about the relationship of a modern spiritually appropriate worldview to psychology. I know better than many an opponent, perhaps, the objections that can be raised when the beginnings of such a worldview are formulated. But I believe I also know that, albeit entirely unconsciously, the longing for such a psychology is present today in countless souls. It therefore needs to be said over and over again. Just as one does not need to be a painter to feel the beauty of a painting, so too one does not need to be a spiritual scientist although one can, to a certain extent, become one. To be able to test whether what I am saying here is true. Just as one can feel the beauty of a painting without being a painter oneself, so with ordinary common sense, one can perceive what the spiritual scientist says about the soul. That one can see it, I think I have established all the more firmly in recognizing how souls thirst for a profounder approach to psychology and to the great riddles of existence in relation to the soul. The aim of a modern worldview, such as has been outlined here today, does in fact represent the desire of countless people, though they are not ordinarily aware of it. It forms the pain, the sorrow, the privation, the wish of countless people, of all those who are serious about what we must regard as constructive forces in face of the many forces of decline present in our age. Anyone today who wishes to advocate a worldview for the times must realize that he has to speak, think, and will in harmony with what the souls in our serious age, if in many cases unconsciously, strive for. And I believe, if I may close on this note, that in just such fundamentals of a worldview as I have today elaborated on, lies something of what countless souls strive for today, because they need it as spiritual content, as living spiritual life for the present and for the immediate future. The end of Lecture 2.